Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program. Well, thanks for being with us. In this spoken hour, which is our second hour, our panel is on the legal implications of marriage, same-sex and otherwise. And the point is, I suppose, that we've seen significant marriage equality rallies around our nation this weekend. Lots of people turned out, and a survey by Crosby Texter shows clearly that a majority of Australians support a conscience vote on marriage equality. 72% support a free vote in our federal parliament. But we've also seen TV ads supported by the Australian Christian Lobby refused by major networks. These ads, which you can see on social media certainly, and they've been to air on Foxtel, they show same-sex marriage as an iceberg with a ship approaching. It reminds me a bit of the Titanic, I've got to say. So the issue is very, very alive. And it's also clear from Crosby Texter that 17% of Australians are very opposed to a conscience vote on marriage equality. So it's not settled by a long shot. The point is, you probably know that Warren Entsch happens to be the Liberal MP who's spearheading the cross-party push to legalise same-sex marriage. He has promised that he'll introduce his private members' bill to legalise same-sex marriage, and he's had it co-sponsored by Labor, the Greens and Independents this Tuesday, in 2 days' time. He has further said that he wants to take the issue to the Coalition Party Room the following Tuesday, in 8 days' time. He says that he wants the Federal Coalition Party Room to allow a free vote. Now, I discovered that a free vote is code for something quite important, because apparently in the Coalition, a free vote is more important than a conscience vote. In Federal Liberal Party terms, a free vote means that even the front bench can make up their own minds, not only the back benches. Well, as you may have been watching tonight, ABC TV's Compass has just run two programs, which started with a feature film, but it's been broken into two parts called Limited Partnerships. And the programs address some of the social history, some of the legal implications, and the penalties of same-sex marriage being denied to citizens. So tonight, on our panel, we're joined by three people who know something about the consequences of living without the benefit of marriage. First up, Kirk Marcolina is the producer, writer and cinematographer on the program Limited Partnerships. Kirk, welcome to the program.
Hi there, Noel. Thanks for having me.
And in our Melbourne studios, Dr. Paula Gerber is the deputy director of the Castan Centre for Human Rights and associate professor at Monash University. Paula, thank you for joining us.
Good night. Thank you.
And fresh from Hollywood in LA, on the phone at 6 a.m. in the morning his time, is Tony Sullivan. Now, Tony is an Australian in LA who's been at the very pointy end of US immigration laws for longer than some of us have been alive, ever since he became one of the first two people to challenge American law on marriage equality in their US Supreme Court. Tony, thank you for joining us. Well, can I begin actually, Kirk, with you? You made this film that we've seen two parts of with Tom Miller. He worked on it for over 14 years. You've been working on it for years too. Why such strong motivation to make the film?
Well, I think first and foremost, Tony and Richard were marriage pioneers that I knew nothing about. And I got married to my husband in 2003 in Canada, and I thought I was on the cutting edge of what was happening in marriage equality. And I was amazed to learn about Richard and Tony's story that went back 40 years before then.
And I had no idea now, an Australian was involved.
Yeah, you know, it was amazing. And myself marrying an Australian and being an American, it was very similar to what Richard and Tony did, except decades later. So I was instantaneously intrigued by their story and thought that the gay and lesbian community and the community at large needed to hear how marriage equality started. And it really did start in large part because of these two gentlemen.
an Australian and an American. I was very surprised. Kirk, American accent, I can hear it. Yeah. Did you connect with them there or here? How did it happen?
No, actually, it was in L.A. My filmmaking partner, Tom Miller, had started making a film about binational couples and had followed several couples who were living in America. One of them was American and the other was from another country. And simply because they were same-sex couples, they couldn't just get married to get citizenship for the non-American. And so he, my filmmaking partner Tom, was following these couples and had interviewed Richard and Tony as part of the film and was using them more as an historical couple.
As one of them.
Yeah. But more sort of looking back at how that started and was following these the other couples' stories, you know, currently. And was doing that in 2001, 2002, and then put the film away. And it wasn't until 2008 when the sort of gay marriage conversation began in earnest in the United States that I went to Tom and said, you know, we really should go back to Richard and Tony and see if they'd be interested in exploring their story more and fleshing that out into the documentary that was on Compass this evening.
Tony Sullivan, can we come to you? Because there might be the odd listener who missed the program on Compass tonight. And I'm just sort of intrigued, even though I've seen it, to get you to explain that as an Australian, just how you ended up being one of the first two people to challenge marriage equality in the US Supreme Court. How did it happen?
Well, what happened is I met Richard in Los Angeles in 1971 when I was here as a tourist. We met, ironically enough, in a bar called The Closet. We had a wonderful summer together. I got an extension on my visa, and then I knew I had to leave the country. And so I was going on to Ireland and England and heading back to Australia. And we were writing to each other on a daily basis by a snail mail. And we realized that we wanted to be together. Richard asked me to come back to America to be with him, and that was why I came back. And of course, eventually, my visa ran out, and after we had managed to get extensions, so I wouldn't be undocumented. And we realized also, we were very aware by our own experience, that the law discriminated in a way that was unacceptable to us. And we discussed the issue, and we put it on hold for 6 months, and we decided to come out and fight the immigration laws, which at the time said that gay people were not allowed into the country.
Now, this is 1971. This is 1971.
Yeah, the law said we were mental defectives and not allowed into the country as tourists, not allowed to be naturalized, and if naturalized, stripped of our citizenship and deported. At the same time, gay people were being put in jail still for being gay in this society. And we just felt this was unacceptable, and we also were so involved with each other, we were not prepared to be separated. I had at one point applied for Richard to have a visa for Australia, but that was turned down with a very nasty remark about Filipinos from the, Richard was half Filipino, from the Australian consulate here in Los Angeles. And so we decided to fight the issue on freedom of religion. We were going to get a holy union in a church that did that for gay people.
Well, I actually saw Troy Perry. He was the founder of the Metropolitan Community Church in the film, I'm sure, didn't I?
That's right. And Troy was a friend of mine, and I went to see Troy, and he agreed that he would, you know, perform a holy union for us, and we were going to fight the government on the issue of freedom of religion. And then while we were putting it all together, a woman called Cleela Rorix in Boulder, Colorado, began to issue same-sex marriage licenses. We watched it for a month because, you know, in law there's a thing called good faith to make sure that we could get married in good faith and believe that the marriages were legal. And we flew to Boulder, Colorado and got married. And Richard petitioned the U.S. government for me to stay here as the spouse of a U.S. citizen. They responded to his petition with the following decision. These are their words. You have failed to establish that a bona fide marital relationship can exist between two faggots. Close quote.
Those words were written there. They were written there.
They're written on a document. I still have the document. Strangely enough, they gave us what we needed. They gave us a weapon to go and fight them in court, and fight them we did.
Now, you did get deported from the USA in 1985. That's 14 years after you'd met Richard. But tell the story of those who need to catch up. What happened with the deporting?
Well, actually, it was called voluntary departure. It's that's just a technical term. But
so you choose to
difference.
Do it. Mm-hmm.
You choose to do it in order to not be banished from the country for till death. And anyhow, at that time, we had applied again for Richard to have immigration to Australia, and they turned him down on the grounds that he didn't qualify. They ignored our marriage. And the Australian government held out, and but the day before we were due to leave America, in a conversation that I had with their immigration consul, they came up with an offer, which I didn't like, but my attorney said we had to accept if we wanted somewhere to go. And that was we were to leave the country, leave the United States, stay out in the world for 6 months, and at the end of 6 months, we could get a visa for Richard to come to Australia, and we had to enter Australia a day apart, and we were not to talk to any press on the way. We kept our side of the agreement. We did not talk to the press. We turned down Ian Hislop, I think he was with Channel 7, and also Phil Donahue of The Donahue Show, both of whom had approached us in Germany. And eventually we got the visa, not easily, but got it for Richard to come to Australia. It was a tourist visa. We entered a day apart. I got him to go in first, because I didn't trust the government to let him in if I went in first. And when we got to Australia, they did not keep their agreement. Their behavior was totally unacceptable. And for me as an Australian, heartbreaking. I had always said to Americans, I'd always compared our governments and said our country was better than theirs as far as government. And we at that point left Australia. With our remaining $500, we had spent all our money on that 6 months outside the country, remaining $500, and we ended up living in an abandoned house in Ireland, 9 miles south of the Northern Irish border. And then one night, I said to Richard, I said, you know, good things can happen to you just as easily as bad things, and the discussion was such we should be home in Los Angeles, where our family were, you know, Richard's, all Richard's family, who are my family as well, and all our friends. And we said, well, that's where we belong. And so I rang up a friend in L.A., and the next day we were flying into Mexico, and I entered the United States illegally because the immigration was so racist, they were busy looking for people who were non-white and assumed that white people were
so
American.
Richard got through because he was American, and you got through because you were white, basically.
I got through because I was white. Richard flew in the next day. Yes, and as an American citizen, he could not be declined entry.
But can I ask you, though, you've just told us you entered illegally, and I know that you've been basically undocumented forever and ever. What's your status now? Is the Immigration Department tracking this phone call as we speak? What's the story?
I'm not worried about that. You know, back in the days when we first fought the government, we put up with police harassment and surveillance and things, including a raid on our home with guns drawn. But no, these days I feel secure in that sense. First of all, gay people no longer are defined as mental defectives and psychopathic personalities. Our sexuality isn't against the law, and I'm protected to some degree by my notoriety. And also President Obama intervened and got the Immigration Department to apologize to Richard posthumously and to me for the use of the word faggot. So, you know, the problem is that my documentation is not occurring, and it should since the Supreme Court decision, but I'm not very happy with my attorney. He doesn't seem to be doing his work because there is no movement on the issue at the moment.
Well, Tony, can I ask you one more question? And that's to do with history, because there'll be young listeners who don't remember a lot of the past. And you mention in the film that when you were younger, you said your mother wanted to get you lobotomized. For people who don't know what that's about, what do you mean by that?
Well, one of the things that was done to gay people, I mean, gay people back in the old days, something that younger people don't understand, our parents used to discriminate against us, kick us out of home when we were like 15 and things like that. Life was pretty torrid, and some parents sought refuge in lobotomy, which is removing, I believe, the frontal lobe of the mind or something, the brain, in order to quote-unquote, change their children. And mother evidently planned that for me. Fortunately, my father, I got wind of it. I had the friend tell my father, and my father let my mother know that he would have his own doctors inspect me, and if I didn't need their interference, he would sue her and sue the doctors, and so the doctors backed right off. But I've met gay people in my generation who were lobotomized, and what was done to them was a crime.
Look, I think it was Dr. Neil McConaughey was the aversion specialist who was based in Sydney, I think, who did a lot of that stuff in the 60s and 70s, and I've met people who've been through the shocks. Dr. Perla Gerber, can I bring you in here? How common were these medical interventions by parents trying to change gay and lesbian kids?
Well, we don't have any exact numbers, but they were unfortunately all too common. But I'd hasten to add that we can't really talk about conversion therapy and treatment of LGBTIQ youth in the past tense, because there is still efforts going on today by parents and others to convert their gay children into a heterosexual lifestyle. It was only last year, in 2014, that Living Waters Australia closed business, and that was one of the leading conversion therapy places in Australia. Clearly, it is a violation of a child's right. It breaches Article 8 of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which is a right to preserve identity. It breaches Article 13 of freedom of expression. If you are a transgender child and you can't express your gender, then that is a breach of that right. And I'd say most importantly, it is a breach of Article 19, which is protection from physical or mental violence. And these conversion therapies clearly amount to mental violence.
Dr. Paula Gerber, can I ask you to put... Tony, you wanted to jump in there? Go ahead.
I just want to add one thing. One could also argue it's a breach of the Human Rights Charter of the UN, the Genocide Convention, because one of the acts of genocide is perpetrating acts upon people that affect their lives.
Dr. Paula Gerber, to put that then, therefore, Tony's just mentioned the UN, where does Australia's debate sort of sit in terms on same-sex marriage in terms of the whole world, in the big picture of things? As you've heard about America and Ireland, but where do we sit if you take into account all the countries? Because you've studied a lot of this, haven't you?
I have, and I think it's very important to recognise that the world is going through a phase of getting further and further divided on this issue. So we have countries in Africa that are imposing harsher penalties and creating new crimes about homosexuality. So there's now an offence of aggravated homosexuality that's never been known to mankind before. So on the one hand, we have many countries that are, and I think it is a direct response to the West going down this path of marriage equality, that they are increasing their persecution of gays. Then we have the West, where Australia is really standing on its own as not going down the path of marriage equality. So you look to the UK, you look to Canada, the US, South American countries, New Zealand. They've all gone down this path of marriage equality in a peaceful, constructive manner. And Australia's resistance to this movement is really putting us apart. But at the same time, I've really dug down into international human rights law to try and determine, is there a human right to same-sex marriage? And the conclusion I have reached from studying all the jurisprudence out of the UN is that there is a human right to same-sex couples to marry, but it is not yet recognised by the UN. I think it's just a matter of time before they revisit this issue and will come down to the conclusion that anti-discrimination, non-discrimination laws require that the dignity and equality of all people be recognised, including the right to marry.
Now, that's interesting that you mentioned the UN has not yet recognised it. But Dr. Paula Gerber, can I ask you, is the chief issue about marriage equality, do you think?
I think marriage equality is an important issue, in large part because of the message that it sends to the rest of society. If the government is discriminating against lesbian and gay and bisexual, transgender, intersex people, then it sends a message to the rest of society that you can too. We treat them differently. Why shouldn't you? But I want us to get on with marriage equality just to get it out of the way so we can fight some of the bigger issues. We have 77 countries around the world that still treat homosexuality as a crime, including many on our doorstep. There are still 8 Pacific nations and a dozen in Asia that treat homosexuality as a crime. We need to be starting or participating in a global movement that says we cannot treat LGBTI people as criminals.
Dr. Paul Gerber, though, can I ask you, the minority of Australians who oppose a conscience vote on marriage equality, they say that this will change the nature of marriage for heterosexuals because the tradition has been man and woman only. Do they have a point in your view? You study jurisprudence.
I have, and I think that their argument is very weak. And I think that for this, that marriage is a social construct. It is not something that was written in stone thousands of years ago and has never changed. In Britain in the 1700s, Anglicans and Catholics couldn't marry. When Australia was colonised, they took their marriage laws and said, well, actually, no, we don't think that applies to a new colony like Australia. We are not going to prohibit marriage between people of different religions. Many people living today remember the days when people of different races could not marry.
In the United States, in fact,
In the United States. So marriage is constantly evolving. It is not frozen in time. Our High Court has said that in the case of Ree Kevin. Marriage is not frozen in time. It constantly evolves in accordance with changing societal attitudes. And all the polls in Australia make it very clear that Australian society is ready to embrace marriage equality.
You're on ABC Radio around Australia. Noel Debien with you. My guests in this hour are Kirk Marcolina, who's the producer, writer, cinematographer on Limited Partnerships, the film which has been to air on ABC TV Compass last Sunday and this Sunday. Dr. Paula Gerber, who's Deputy Director of the Caston Centre for Human Rights and also an Associate Professor at Monash in the Law Faculty. And also Tony Sullivan, who's an Australian in LA, who was one of the first two people to challenge American law on marriage equality in the US Supreme Court. You may have a view, you may want to ask a question. 1-300-800-222 is our number, 1-300-800-222. And we're happy to take your calls if you want to call. But Kirk, can I come back to you? We're just talking about marriage being the main issue. Now, you're not just a filmmaker, but you are also married yourself.
Sure am, yes.
Has marriage solved all the issues?
Well, I don't think one. I think marriage is incredibly important. And I feel like in America, you know, marriage, it's so great that we have marriage equality because it allows people that are in same-sex relationships and within a binational couple to sponsor their partner for citizenship and many other rights. But I think there's above and beyond the rights that are
I'm thinking about your daughter. You given, have a nine-year-old daughter.
Yeah, I was just getting there. I think the word marriage and by me saying that my husband is my husband and not just my partner is incredibly important. I can walk into the fish shop and tell the guy behind the counter, this is my husband, and he understands our relationship in a way that is very different than if you just said, this is my partner. And I think it's really important for myself, for my family, for my daughter, that we have marriage and that I can use that terminology because it's so meaningful in our society.
But our government won't recognize yours yet, will it?
Correct, yes. So they don't see us as married. They see us as de facto partners, and the whole parenting issue is a whole other issue that we can talk about some other night, probably. But
another set of issues, that are connected.
Yeah, because we had Sophie through a surrogate in the United States. So,
Tony Sullivan, can I come back to you? Because I have to say, as I watched the film, I was sort of surprised at all the footage that had been carefully put away and the careful documentation of your life with Richard. And I got the impression that you may have been very interested in gay and lesbian rights from a young age. Am I right?
Well, I came out as a gay person when I was about 15. Well, I discovered I was gay when I was about 15, and I never saw any great need to conceal it other than when I worked for Qantas. But even there, I was known as the flaring flight attendant. But
I saw the childhood film as well, I've got to say. I think there might have been some hints there, Tony.
Yes, when I saw that film too, I thought, oh dear, it was obvious. I found great joy in discovering I was gay. It answered a lot of questions for me. But I started to become interested in gay rights without fully realizing it very early on. I just I saw injustice when in Sydney a friend of mine was taken off to jail for being gay. By the mid-60s, it was becoming a real issue with me. And then I heard about some activities that were taking place in America, and that heightened my interest further. By the time Richard and I came out, after we'd got married, I became a full-fledged gay activist. I mean, I worked on issues not just gay marriage. I worked on school protecting school teachers and a lot of other issues, and helped found the very first international gay, lesbian, we'll call gay and lesbian in those days, political organization. I'm very dedicated to the liberation and freedom of our people. Richard was too. Richard was ahead of me in gay political awareness, and we were very aware of what we were doing when we came out. I mean, our actions were pure because we wanted to be together. We loved each other. It was totally legitimate, but at the same token, we set out to break the prejudice that existed because of marriage equality. So that's sort of how it evolved.
Tony, can I ask you a difficult question? Because this is also documented in the film. You and Richard lived through the period where HIV and AIDS killed many of your friends. And as of this year, 2015, I think more than 650,000 Americans and more than 7,000 Australians have died. Do you think you and Richard were just lucky? Or is your relationship part of what prevented you from getting the virus?
We shared that information with each other. We acknowledged that our relationship saved our lives. We were monogamous, so as a result, the bug didn't get into our lives in that sense. But we lost our closest friends, our very closest friends. I'm still experience pain of the loss of them because our friendships were intense. When you live the kind of life we live, fight, you know, as activists fighting a system, the people you become friends with are a little different than just someone you know from the local coffee shop. And they all died, the whole lot of them.
We should take a couple of calls because there's a couple of people who'd like to make a comment. 1-300-800-222 if you want to join in. Let's go to, I think, John, have I got you in Woodlands in Perth?
In Perth. The Human Rights Commissioner, Mr. Tim Wilson, has been highly critical of the three proposed gay marriage laws before Parliament.
Yep.
Saying that they don't go anywhere near providing adequate provision for personal conscience and religious freedom.
You mean in defence of religious organisations that conduct marriages?
What's happened in Europe and in America is that either individual people or organisations have been sued because of their beliefs. Mm-hmm. For instance, adoption agencies have been forced to close in America and in Spain. And there's been a whole stream of these cases. Mm-hmm. Mr. Paul Kelly is an esteemed journalist. And in the editorial in the Weekend Australian yesterday, pointed this out.
Look, can I take Dr. Paula Gerber? Do you mind taking that one?
Because I'd be happy to speak to that one because I think it's a really important issue that there's a lot of misinformation out there about. Yeah. Firstly, no religious person will be forced to solemnise a marriage that they don't believe in. So that's point number one. Second point is, if a religious person sets up a business, so they set up a company that is going to make wedding cakes or have wedding recitals in their premises, then you can't have it both ways. You can't say, I am a business and I want all the protection and the corporate shield, the corporate veil that goes with having a business, but then as an individual, I get to discriminate against people. And the Cobar decision out of the Victorian Court of Appeal a little while ago made that very clear, where a Christian camp, a church, set up a business, bought a property and ran a camp. And they said, we are not going to allow an LGBTI group, youth group, to come and use our facilities. And the court said, no, you can't do that. You're not a church here. This is a business. And finally, I'd say, as point number three, that I think it's really important to recognise that this is discrimination. And I think an easy way to deal with this is to say, how would we feel if that same business said, I am not going to serve you, I'm not going to make your wedding cake because you are Indian. I'm not going to do your flowers because you are a Muslim. We don't allow people in this country to discriminate on the basis of race or religion. And that same theory, basic practice of human rights says we also will not discriminate against someone because of their sexual orientation or gender identity.
Well, John, thank you very much for your call. We've got quite a few on the board. We've got to move on. Can I take Tina? Have I got you in Curtin?
Yeah, good evening.
Good evening. What did you want to say, Tina?
A long time ago, I read in a book a reason behind homosexuality, but I never heard and read about medical invention, you know, what's it called when you discover things, you know?
A discovery, yeah.
In this modern age about it. Nobody talks anything about it. And yet, this person, all the way from Tibet, wrote this chapter in his book and said that the baby, while developing in the mother's womb, is lacking some vitamin K or something else.
And oh, so you're looking for a medical explanation, are you? Is that
medical
what?
Medical explanation, and to this day, nobody says anything. Of course, we are going to accept people with disabilities and difficulties or whatever, this and that, you know. But
do you believe, Tina, that same-sex orientation is a disability? Is that your view?
It's not disability as a lack of a power of thinking, reasoning, and so forth. It's a different kind, brain damage kind thing. But nobody wants to accept that.
I'd like to speak to this one, if I may.
Absolutely. Go right ahead. Please, Paula.
Okay. I think, again, we can frame this question as, well, no, there's been no medical breakthrough that has, or discovery that has determined why someone is heterosexual. Sexual orientation, sexuality, is a natural condition that varies along a spectrum, with some people being undeniably 100% heterosexual, some people undeniably 100% homosexual, and the vast majority of people are somewhere in between along the spectrum. And what science has discovered is that homosexuality exists in every single species, and homophobia exists in only one, and that is mankind.
Well, look, thank you, Tina, for your call. Thanks for your observation. I think we should go to Peter in Vaucluse. Peter.
Just sorry to interrupt for one second.
Oh,
my
Tony?
Phone seems to be dying.
Oh no.
Yeah, I'm looking for my spare phone. Maybe I should give your producer my cell phone number.
Absolutely. I'll put you on hold, okay? Sorry, Peter.
Yes, hello, Tony. Look, I'm very sympathetic to what your panel is talking about. I've got a friend of mine whose daughter is actually a lesbian, and she, unfortunately, has tried to take her life on a couple of occasions. And so I understand where they're coming from, and I'm very sympathetic towards that. I guess my concern is I do think we need to, as a democratic society, need to be able to allow all points of view to be viewed in society. And unfortunately, this debate is not allowed to happen in society. What are your thoughts on that?
Paula, maybe you'd like to take
yes,
that?
Yes, I'm happy to take that one as well. I think the debate between Penny Wong and Corey Bernardi was an excellent illustration of how this debate can be conducted in a civilised way, where it doesn't come down to name-calling and really abuse and vitriol between the two opposing viewpoints. I think it is important to have this debate and to bring people around. And what we've seen with Obama and with Hillary Clinton and with many others is that people do change their attitudes on this issue once they have a bit of education and awareness raising. So I'm all for having a constructive debate between the different sides, but what I would be very concerned about is having a referendum on an issue like this, because I think it does bring out a lot of fear-mongering, and I think we've seen that with the Australian Christian Lobby's recent campaign with the iceberg. I mean, it is trying to terrorise people. It is trying to scare people that, you know, the sky is going to fall down, this is going to be the end of the world if we allow two people in love who happen to be of the same sex to get married. So all for constructive debate, but I fear that that's not going to happen.
Yeah, look, I understand your point of view, but I do think that we are in a democratic society, and when you take away the opportunity for people to express their views, that's a very concerning environment. We've had that in the past on many occasions, and it just does. It's not right. Everyone should be able to express their points of view, regardless of either way.
Look.
Yes, but it has to be within certain limits. I mean, as we saw with the Adams Goods affairs, if it's going to resort to racist vilification, that's where the limit lies. And if it's going to resort to vilification of a whole sexual minority, then we need to put a stop to that.
Peter, thank you very much for your call. Paula, can I be actually more specific about that? Because in less than 8 days, there will be possibly a party room decision on whether there'd be a free conscience vote, a free vote actually in Parliament from the Coalition. Texter Crosby says 72% of Australians support a conscience vote, but there are pros and cons in all this because you've just raised them. In the American situation, it was a Supreme Court ruling that did it. In Ireland, it was a referendum that did it. What are the pros and cons for this country in those things?
Great question, because each country has its own unique legal system, and ours is different from both the Irish and the American system. So firstly, we don't have a Bill of Rights in Australia. Mm. So there is no real opportunity to bring a court action like we saw in the Windsor case in the US Supreme Court, challenging the law on the basis that it is a breach of human rights. So that's not an option open to us. A referendum in our country is used only for amending the Constitution, and marriage is not something that is mandated in the Constitution as being only between a man and a woman. So a referendum is not necessary or helpful, I think. The Marriage Act was amended in 2004 by John Howard to make it from being gender neutral to actually explicitly saying marriage is between a man and a woman only. And that was passed by an Act of Parliament, and it needs to be amended by an Act of Parliament. Now, the issue of a conscience vote is very complex because...
We need to distinguish between free vote and conscience vote.
Free vote or conscience vote, yes.
In the Liberal Party, the free vote means that even the front bench can do it, and a conscience vote would mean the back bench could do it.
But the principle is the same, that somebody is allowed to not vote in accordance with party lines because of their conscience. And in the past, if we look at when the conscience vote has been used in the past, it is predominantly for life and death matters, for euthanasia, for the death penalty, for abortion, if you consider a fetus to be a living being. So it's those sort of issues. I don't think that a conscience vote actually applies in the situation where you are voting on whether a minority group should be allowed to exercise their human rights. So I actually don't think a conscience vote is appropriate in this instance. I think it should be that the parties adopt a position consistent with international human rights norms and standards and respect for equality and dignity and non-discrimination, and vote to undo the discrimination that John Howard brought into the Marriage Act in 2004.
Now there's another point we do need to bring up. Tony, can I bring you back in? I know we've got you on your cell phone now.
Yeah.
The Defence of Marriage Act, DOMA. A lot of people in Australia won't know what that was. In 1996 in America, can you remind us what President Clinton signed into law in US federal law?
President Bill Clinton signed into law. What happened? The Republicans had put forward a vote banning marriage between people of the same sex, and stating specifically that marriage is to be performed between a man and a woman. And Bill Clinton, who was no friend of our community, he claimed to be a friend but wasn't, vetoing it.
Hello? You're breaking up, that's all. Try again.
Yeah, I'll go out on the terrace. That should help my neighbours.
Very homely. I'll get out where the signal's better.
Okay. Anyhow, Bill Clinton signed the bill into law at like 3 o'clock in the morning.
I do recall it. That Defensive Act. Were you there, Kirk, at the time?
Yeah, I was, and it was. I remember thinking, you know, it was passed by a huge majority in our Congress, and it was veto proof, basically. So Bill Clinton couldn't have stopped it from becoming law. But I know myself and a lot of other activists at the time were hoping that he just didn't sign it, and it would have become law anyway, and it would have been a sort of silent protest. But yet, in the dead of night, he did sign it, and he came out with a statement saying, "I've always thought that marriage was between a man and a woman," and people are shocked to see that. And that's one of the things about the film, that people are like, really, Clinton signed that? And and he did.
Paula,
Dr. also the person who gave us Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Oh, yeah, indeed. He's the same person who gave Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That's right. Dr. Paula Gerber, can I ask you, 11 years ago, the Howard government passed the Marriage Legislation Amendment Bill in August 2004. Is that similar to the DOMA thing?
It absolutely is. It was prompted at the time by some Australian same-sex couples who'd gone to Canada to get married. And if that if the Marriage Act hadn't been changed in that way and they'd come back to Australia, it would have required everyone in Australia or governments in Australia to recognise that as a valid marriage, having been validly performed in Canada. So the amendments to the Marriage Act were rushed through in part to prevent those valid marriages being recognised in Australia, and also to exactly as DOMA did, to say we are not going to recognise marriages of the same-sex couples. The big difference between America and Australia, though, is that in America, marriage is a state-based issue. So each of their 50 states decide what their marriage laws are going to be. In Australia, of course, it is a federal issue, and we've seen some failed attempts by states and territories to enact marriage at a state level. It is an issue that, under the Constitution, marriage falls within the jurisdiction of the federal government, and that's where it needs to be addressed.
Kirk Michaelina, I think you're American ambassador to Australia. And if I'm right, John Berry and his husband Curtis Yee are married.
Yes.
But that would not be recognised in this country.
That's correct. And when I came here with my husband, it wasn't because we were married that I got permanent residency. It was because of our interdependent relationship. And so the marriage certificate that, you know, Rob and I got back in 2003 was just one piece of evidence, but really wasn't seen as a valid marriage by Australia.
And Paula, can I ask? Tony, go ahead.
I may be wrong in this, but I seem to recall while Richard and I were fighting our fight here that an Australian ambassador, and I forget to which country, took his same-sex partner to that country with the blessing of the Australian government. And I remember at the time we were being very outraged that an ambassador, a person of privilege, was being given that advantage while we, the ordinary people, weren't getting it.
Look, it's complicated. I know the Vatican has just refused a same-sex ambassador as well. It's a complicated thing.
The one from France.
Yeah, that's right, when it's at a diplomatic level. We should take a few more calls because people are still keen to say something. Let's go to Aaron in Werribee. Aaron, have I got you?
Yes.
Aaron, what would you like to say or what would you like to ask?
Just taking up Paula's point on homosexuals in the animal kingdom, there's a lot of there is an article in the BBC said that there's homosexual acts in the animal kingdom, but there's no reason to think that any of those homosexual acts are actually linked to a same-sex attraction. Also, there's an interesting study by the Faraday Institute. It says that there's actually no evidence that there is a homosexual gene or anything like that. So I wouldn't say that it's very clear.
Okay, there's a second question I want to take before we answer that, if you don't mind. I'm going to have to cut you, I'm sorry to do it, but there's a second question which is very similar to that, and that's Rod in Fairfield. Have I got you?
Yes, hi.
Rod, you wanted to ask about, I think, something quite...
I wanted to ask, what's the evolutionary purpose of homosexuals?
Now, that's an interesting question as well, because it's linked to that, isn't it? Paula, would you like...
I'll respond firstly to the guy in Werribee, sorry, I've forgotten his first name, about same-sex attraction. And I think he's mistaken in that assertion. And there's a very well-documented case of penguins who everyone knows mates for life, a couple of male penguins that mated and then endeavoured to breed by taking a rock and treating it as if it was an egg. So there's quite a few in species where they do mate for life. There are examples of same-sex couples staying together. In other species where, you know, they mate and quickly move on, then obviously we can't make the same assertions.
I'm getting awful visions of couples in Australia with Barbie dolls, though. But the point you're making, though, is that the penguins actually do, and we do know that there are these lifelong... So there is some... I've just been reading some stuff about evolutionary stuff, and I wonder if you've seen it. The reason being... The reason I read, and this has been advanced as a theory only at this beginning, that because in the male of the species, in many mammals in particular, but also fish, there are some fish that do this too, because the male is competitive and is actually programmed hormonally to fight, that there is an evolutionary advantage in homosexual attractions because it allows males to form bonds in some species. Now, that's only a theory, but I have heard that.
Yes, and I've read some others as well, but I can't remember off the top of my head what they were.
Sorry, go on.
Can I interrupt at this point? You know, we can come up with all kinds of evolutionary arguments.
Oh, yeah.
One of the best I ever heard is the human race's solution to overpopulation. But the whole argument of evolution really is off the point. The fact is there are people like myself, like Kirk, who fall in love and love another human being. And because of that love, we should be allowed to be together. Whether people or not wonder whether we're here to decrease the population, overpopulated world, is not the issue. The issue is I met Richard Adams, Richard Adams, and I fell in love, and we went life together, and the system or society
couldn't agree
stand
more.
Against it.
Paula, I couldn't agree more. From a human rights perspective, every single human being has fundamental human rights, including the right to dignity, equality and non-discrimination. So regardless of why, that is just an irrelevant question. The fact is that they are a human being. That's our question. And once we say, yes, they are, then they deserve our respect and equality.
Kirk, I wonder if you have a response or any reaction to the question about your evolutionary purpose.
Yeah, well, I think Tony hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's not, for me, it's who I am. You know, I don't think about why I'm here on the planet. Or, I fell in love with a man, and that's who I am. That's intrinsically how I was made by my creator. And I think... It's absolutely right. It is irrelevant in the larger sense.
Paula, if this bill should go up, does it solve a major problem in your view? If the co-sponsored bill goes up and actually succeeds, does it really solve a major problem?
It solves a problem. It's sort of, you know, one we can tick off the list towards LGBTI equality, but there are still many others that need to be addressed, and one of them is to do with immigration. I mean, we talked about how in 1971, I think it was, that Tony and Richard couldn't, there was no country where they could live together. The position's not that dissimilar now because, yes, Australia allows same-sex couples who can establish that they are in an ongoing, genuine relationship.
Like de factos. Yeah.
Like de factos to come to Australia. But let's take, for example, an Australian man who falls in love with a Sri Lankan man. Mm-hmm. Now, Sri Lanka criminalises homosexuality. Not only, it's one of the few countries that explicitly between both men and lesbians as well. Mm. So if that couple is to live in Sri Lanka, they're under threat of being arrested at any time. Yet they're not allowed into Australia until they can prove
that Sri Lankan's not a terrorist.
Well, indeed. But until they can prove that they have a genuine and ongoing relationship. So where are they to live whilst they establish over a period of 1 or 2 years that they have a genuine relationship? So that's a big barrier. Another huge issue we need to address is asylum seekers who are LGBTI. I mean, the cases that are coming out of our refugee review tribunals and out of the courts still are basically asking gay men to prove that they are gay by, for example, producing videos or photographs of them having sex with their boyfriend.
I would have thought that was illegal in the first place, but there
you go. It is. European courts of human rights have said you cannot do that, but it is still this obsession with being gay is about what goes on in the bedroom rather than being a person's identity. So we have a lot of problems in the refugee space, in family formation. I mean, it's great that Kirk was able to access surrogacy in the US. In Australia, you can't. A gay couple, unless they can find a woman who is happy to do it for them completely voluntarily, they have to go overseas, and all sorts of issues arise then.
That's a subject we need to take up in another program because it's a complex subject, and I was shocked to discover that there's more than a million kids in the United States now who are the children of same-sex couples, and that there are thousands and thousands in Australia. So it's actually a very real issue that we must come to. But Tony, can I ask you, why marriage? Is it particular to the United States that it had to be marriage?
Richard and I actually didn't set out to in our minds to bring about marriage equality as we know it today. We set out to remove discrimination brought about by marriage. All that time back, it was just a small embryo of what we were dealing with. But marriage laws are the center of discrimination. all around the world. Kirk and I have a slight disagreement on, not disagreement on this, but we had a discussion recently about this. I happen to think that a part of the problem is the whole religion and marriage being in many people's minds tied in religion. You know, it's a combination of church and state. And so my feeling is that actually an ideal situation would be to say to the churches, you have marriage as a religious thing, but we give you no legal benefits attached to religious marriage. And then when it comes to law, we remove the word marriage from the law, set up a new situation for acknowledging relationships. The reason I feel that is it takes away the stuff with marriage, which for a lot of people is purely based in religion. And I saw where a Presbyterian minister in Australia said that if marriage equality occurred in Australia, he would not accept the secular side of the...
Yeah, that's a live issue, too.
Married
people. Mm. No, that's absolutely
and
true.
I thought he... Devon?
Go on.
I thought he got the issue right in a strange way. Let religions have marriage and let us under the law remove marriage from the law, the word marriage, I mean, from the law.
Now, that's a nuanced position. Paula, can I go to you? Because we've got Paula, can I go to you? We've got an SMS question from Xavier. He's asking, would it be different if gay marriage was a legal thing rather than a church thing? And we have addressed that in a way, but it's another direct question on the matter.
Yes, I mean, marriage is a secular institution. Australia is a secular country. And over two-thirds of the marriages that are now performed in Australia are performed by civil celebrants, not by religious ministers. So I think religious people do feel strongly about their marriages and they are entitled to do that. But I read a wonderful piece in a New York newspaper from a Jewish woman who said, I don't eat bacon, but I don't go and tell everyone else that they can't eat bacon. And I think it's the same thing. You know, if religious people want to get married in their religious institutions, then we should embrace that. And if same-sex couples want to get married by civil celebrants, then we should also embrace that.
I think Paula just touched on what I'm trying to say, saying in Australia marriage is a secular institution and performed by civil servants. If that's the case, marriages performed by religious ministers should not become and not be seen as secular marriages until such time as participants separate from the minister go to the government and accord it. And a lot of countries have that already and have had it for years.
That's what happens. A marriage is not a marriage in Australia, even if it's performed by a minister, unless it complies with the secular laws, the Marriage Act, and they go through and register it with the Registrar of Births, Deaths and Marriages and the like. Mm. Can I just make one point?
You've got 20 seconds, please.
Okay. The other reason we need marriage equality in Australia is for the children. The instances of youth homelessness, of youth depression and suicide is a crime, as is bullying in schools. And allowing same-sex couples to marry would go
help
a long way
that.
In addressing that.
Last question. Kirk Marcolino, I just want to ask you, where did you get all that footage from? It goes back 40 years.
Yeah, well, great archives, and especially Tony is the best archivist I've ever met. Got lots of stuff in his basement and lots of great things in the archives in America.
I want to thank our panel tonight. Kirk Marcolino, who's the producer, writer, cinematographer, Unlimited Partnerships. Dr. Paula Gerber, Deputy Director of the Kasten Center for Human Rights and also Associate Professor at Monash. Tony Sullivan, on the line from Hollywood, an Australian in LA who's really taken a very important part in the change of attitude within America and perhaps here too. Thank you to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.